Great. Well, it is great to be together tonight for our sixth class in the series on the Gospel of Mark. Thank you guys so much for joining us. We are going to be focusing on chapter 14 tonight, and I've got a couple of points that I want to make here and give you a few practicals that we will be able to will be helpful as you really try to take on the heart of Jesus in your life based on, you know, the things that Mark wrote to the church in the first century. And, you know, just as kind of a reminder, I know I've said this a couple of times, but I do think it's helpful that, you know, Mark is writing about 30 years after Jesus's death. It's an environment where the church was really for the first time facing systematic persecution at the hands of the Roman Empire. And Paul, at this point, had either just been killed or was about to be killed. He's in great danger. And Peter, who was also in Rome, along with Mark and with Paul, was also himself facing danger and would soon after be killed. And so, you know, this is, you know, our brother Mark sitting down to write down the testimony that Peter gave about the life of Jesus, so that we could have it, right? So that future generations of disciples would know who Jesus was, the things that he did and the way that he lived, the way that he showed God's heart. And I just think it's just such an incredible image of just, you know, his conviction to sit down with Peter, whose life was probably under threat at this time, to sit down and say, let's get this story down so that we can tell the world and future generations about who Jesus was. And as we've talked about, you know, the major themes that he's trying to help the church at that time to understand are that Jesus is more than just a hero, kind of like the heroes out of the Greek and Roman myths. He's more than just kind of this, you know, semi-divine person, but that he's God's own son in the flesh. And that Mark also wanted to encourage the early church that's going to be undergoing persecution, that they can face that knowing that God is going to be in control. And that they can, you know, not try to fight against that persecution in an ungodly way, but can face it with the same faith and the same conviction that Jesus faced the persecution that he went through. And so, you know, as we're looking through this series in the Gospel of Mark, we've been just asking, how can I imitate the heart of Jesus in my life today? And so we've talked about the first class was the call to a mission-centered life. You know, how do we really put Jesus, his mission, at the center of our lives? It really did motivate the things that he did. But how can I do that? You know, we talked about the call to faith in the power of God, and Steve talked about faith versus fear, and really just a fundamental choice that we all must make again and again and again about how our lives, you know, what really is controlling the decisions in our lives. I talked about the call to compassion, right? You know, just this, the way that Jesus operated when he saw other people was fundamentally just a view of compassion towards the world. And we talked about how to try to imitate that. Steve talked about the call to be a learner and looking at the example of Jesus's disciples and how really they didn't do a good job following, you know, being learners, but then somehow, you know, eventually they did get it. But then also some of the examples of the people, the blind man at the end of that passage there, who really did understand Jesus's call. And then last week, Steve talked about the call to boldness and, you know, Jesus' interaction with the Jewish leaders in the temple in, you know, during the first part of the Holy Week, the week leading up to his crucifixion, and just calling us all to imitate that heart. And then talking about how, as Shirley shared, that poor widow who really showed the example of righteousness that Jesus was calling the Jewish leaders to imitate. But, you know, these things and the thing that we're going to talk about tonight, these are all really fundamental topics that I think, you know, as we're trying to reach spiritual maturity, these should be things, areas that we're trying to be strong in, right? That these can be strengths in our lives and will really help us to look more like Jesus. And before I really get into my class, I will also remind you of the three things that we talked about, tips to have a successful series. And we talked about reading. The whole Gospel of Mark every week. We're talking about deciding, making decisions every week about the things that we're going to do, practical choices to implement the topics that we're reading about. And then also the third one is to share the decisions that we make with a brother or a sister so that we can help each other to have a victory in these areas. So read, decide, and share. How can we really be successful in this series? Okay, tonight we're going to continue with chapter 14. I hope you're not already asleep. Stay with me. We're getting into the stuff now. Here we go. Chapter 14, Mark 14. You can start in verse 1. And we're going to be talking about the call to spiritual devotion. The call to spiritual devotion. Now, you know, we're picking up Mark's narrative here on the Tuesday before his crucifixion. So his crucifixion is 3 days away at this point. Jesus arrived in Jerusalem, as Steve talked about last week, on a Sunday. And he examined the temple, and then he set up camp, went outside of Jerusalem, a couple of miles away, to Bethany, and he set up camp there. And so, you know, each of these days that we're following here, that Mark follows him, Jesus goes into Jerusalem, does something at the temple, then comes out and then stays the night at Bethany. On Monday, he comes into the temple, into Jerusalem, and then he challenges the unrighteousness of the Jewish leaders, and he cleanses the temple. And then he returns to Bethany that night, on Monday night. On Tuesday, he goes back to the temple, and again, he speaks boldly to the people. He warns against the hypocrisy of the Jewish leaders. These are all things we talked about last week, and the preoccupation that his disciples had with kind of the structure of the temple, talking about how ultimately all of that is going to be destroyed. And then he leaves the temple there, leaves Jerusalem, and goes back to Bethany that night. So we're picking it up here on Tuesday night, that night after he arrives in Bethany. Mark 14 in verse 1. You with me? Here we go. It says, "Now the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were scheming to arrest Jesus secretly and kill him. But not during the festival, they said, or the people may riot. While he was in Bethany reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, 'Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor.' And they rebuked her harshly. 'Leave her alone,' said Jesus. 'Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them anytime you want. But you will not always have me.' What she did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare it for my burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand him over. You know, at first it might kind of seem odd that Mark includes this story here. Here he is telling of Jesus doing very, you know, large public things. He's cleansing the temple. He's preaching in Jerusalem. He's debating the religious leaders. And Mark hasn't really mentioned anything about Jesus's time in Bethany up to this point. He just noted, at least during this week, he's just noticed that Jesus would go back there to sleep. And Mark is about to skip right to another big event that's 2 days away, which is Jesus's Last Supper with his disciples, which happens on Thursday evening. So, you know, we get no mention of what happens all day on Wednesday and also on Thursday morning. All we really get to is from this point here on Tuesday night until Thursday night. And so, you know, the question is, why include this story about what happens in Bethany at this point in the gospel? You know, why does that really stick out in Mark's heart that he wants to mention that? But I think it really does make sense if you see how throughout the gospel, Mark includes seemingly minor stories that bring to light aspects of Jesus's heart and his character that he wants the readers to understand. You know, we saw this a few weeks ago where the disciples were struggling to understand Jesus's teachings again and again. But then a blind man, who Mark talks about, understands it better than anyone. We saw it last week where Mark stops in the middle of Jesus's teaching to show his praise for a poor woman who exemplifies the true righteousness that Jesus is looking for, in contrast to the hypocrisy of the Jewish leaders that he's preaching against. And we see it here again, you know, where Marcus really stops his narrative and calls our attention to this interaction that Jesus has with a woman. Now, what is he trying to help us to see? Well, you know, I'd argue that he's preparing us to understand the heart of Jesus that we're going to see displayed as he approaches and then endures the cross. You know, this woman displays, an aspect of the heart of Jesus that we're going to see Jesus display on the cross. But he shows it to us right now in this woman's example. And that point, that example is a heart of extravagant devotion. It's a heart of extravagant devotion. You know, Mark doesn't really tell us anything about this woman. We don't know who she is, how she got there, or what is motivating her. She shows up with a bottle of pure nard, which is an aromatic essential oil. So, maybe she was the one, we can blame her for starting the essential oil craze, And if you know anything about essential oils, you know that they are expensive. And so here's this woman who shows up and, she's carrying what's likely the most expensive thing that she owns. And she doesn't come and just sprinkle a few drops on Jesus's head. She literally breaks the bottle and pours the entire thing over Jesus's hair, probably dripping down onto the floor. Why? Because she understood who he was, and because she understood that God calls us to extravagant devotion. This is the same heart that we see, that we're going to see Jesus display 2 days later, though only a few paragraphs later in Mark's telling. And, we can pick it up here in verse 32. You can skip down to verse 32, and we can see Jesus display really this same heart towards God. Mark 14, verse 32, says, after they had the Last Supper, it says they went to a place called Gethsemane. And Jesus said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death, he said to them. Stay here and keep watch. Going a little farther, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. Abba, Father, he said, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. Simon, he said to Peter, are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Once more, he went away and prayed the same thing. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. And the church said, amen. They did not know what to say to him. Returning the third time, he said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Enough. The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer. There's so many things that you see in Jesus' heart here that we could talk about, right? His vulnerability with his disciples, with his friends, his perseverance, his relatability to our weaknesses. But what I see most of all in this story is really Jesus' devotion to God, right? Mark has talked several times so far in this gospel about Jesus going off to pray. But until now, we've never heard the content of Jesus's prayers, right? We see the example of Jesus praying, but we actually don't even know what it was that he was praying. And here for the first time, we get a window into how Jesus is wrestling with the Father. And we see him just pouring out his heart, pouring out his, everything he has, and yet ultimately submitting to God's will. You see in this battle an extravagant devotion to God. There is no halfway. There is no close enough. There is no, I get what I want and you get what you want too. Can't we find a middle ground here? No negotiation. It's pure surrender to his Father. Jesus wants anything but the cross. And yet the one thing he wants most of all is God's will to be done in his life. Because God calls us to extravagant devotion. Now, what does this look like for us? When I think about my life, I can think of really kind of two contrasts that I would make. And the first is that God calls us to extravagance instead of stinginess. Extravagance instead of stinginess. What really characterizes your relationship with God? It's so easy to let our relationship with God become characterized by stinginess. You know, we have our little bottle of precious oil, you know, our little bit of time, our little bit of money, our little bit of energy at the end of the day. And we, you know, when God asks us to, we can take our little, you know, our little essential oil dropper out of the bottle and, you know, put a little drop in, because God calls us to put on my little drop, you know, that's fine. But what God calls us to is an extravagant devotion where we lavish our most precious resources on him. It means making our time with him special, not just checking it off the list in the morning. It means finding something that is exciting and that inspires us, that makes that special to us, that relationship. It also means being excellent in the things that we do for God. You know, it has been really, honestly, inspiring to see. So the kids' classes this summer, we've been able, you know, we have kids in both sets of classes. And so we've been able to see the teachers, you know, come on there and do these kids' classes. And honestly, I've been super grateful for the teachers that have taken up, you know, just the role of these classes. It's, by the way, it's really cool seeing the lightning flash in everybody's back windows right now. Oh, if we get knocked out, then amen, God's in control. But that's awesome that we're all, you know, by faith, we're all hanging in there. But it's been really inspiring to see just the example of your hearts, honestly, just in there. I mean, I've seen Kevin and Nat do incredible jobs. I've seen Shirley do an amazing job. I saw the Lozanos were incredible on there. Nelson and Yvette were amazing. I mean, there's so many of you that have just done such a great job. And honestly, it takes time. And you think, man, I'm putting all this work into a class for a three-year-old. You know, like, you know, why am I doing all this work for a three-year-old? You know, but it is, it matters, right? And the kids can tell the work that goes in. And it's honestly, it's true of everything. It's true of everything that happens in the church. It's true of, you know, every way that we serve. You know, when we really give that extra effort to make it excellent, it matters. It matters to God. You see, that's what you see in this woman's heart. But it also matters in our relationship with God when we get that time in the morning or whenever it is that you have your quiet time and you make it special. You know, you make that, you know, a cherished and treasured time rather than something that's just kind of perfunctory. Extravagance over stinginess. The other thing that we see here, and I think especially in this woman's example, is that we see devotion over efficiency. Devotion over efficiency. You know, it's easy to get caught up trying to kind of optimize everything in our lives. Or you say, well, I'm not really being stingy with my time, but I just want to kind of think seriously about how to kind of be most efficient with everything that I'm doing. And some of that is good, right? It's good to want to kind of make, you know, to be effective in the work that we're doing for God. But we can sometimes become so obsessed with optimizing how we're allocating our resources that we forget the larger goal of worship, right? And this is what the crowd did. You know, the crowd criticized this woman for being inefficient. They're saying, hey, you're wasting this, right? You're wasting this. You know, here's this precious thing that you have. You're wasting it on Jesus when we could have been, you know, using it for better purposes. But Jesus says, no, you're missing the point. Here is this woman who's coming with a heart of worship. And she's, you know, pouring herself out, you know, really pouring herself out for me. He's looking for a heart that's truly devoted. It's devotion over efficiency. And so I'd say, you know, if you feel inspired to serve God in some way, I think we probably need to worry less about, you know, is this super effective at reaching people, or is this effective in this way? I think if we're feeling really inspired about honoring God and serving him in some way, go for it, right? I mean, I think we need to have this heart of just like, try to honor him as much as we can. Give our devotion and let God worry about the results. You know, what Jesus shows in his interaction with this woman and then in his example in the Garden of Gethsemane is that God calls all of his followers not to just a dreary stinginess and not to kind of a burdened efficiency, but to extravagant devotion in our walks with him. Let's keep reading. We'll read right through the second half of the chapter here, and then I'll make a final point. So we'll start in verse 43. You guys with me? Let's keep going. It says, just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, Rabbi, and kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Am I leading a rebellion, said Jesus, that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled. Then everyone deserted him and fled. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days will build another, not made with hands. Yet even then, their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? I am, said Jesus. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. The high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses? He asked. You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, prophesy. And the guards took him and beat him. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. You also were with that Nazarene Jesus, she said, but he denied it. I don't know or understand what you're talking about, he said, and went out into the entryway. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, this fellow is one of them. Again, he denied it. After a little while, those standing near said to Peter, surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean. He began to call down curses, and he swore to them, I don't know this man you're talking about. Immediately, the rooster crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me 3 times. And he broke down and wept. You know, what I see in this passage is an incredible contrast. The world around Jesus is in utter turmoil. His followers are afraid or aggressive or uncertain and timid. The Jewish leaders and the Roman officials are insecure or dishonest or brutal. And here is Jesus in the midst of a mob of chaos, and he is utterly calm. It's reminiscent of the storm that Mark talks about on the Sea of Galilee, where the disciples are afraid for their lives. But Jesus is in the midst of it, sleeping on a cushion. Except that in this case, it's an emotional storm. And the one who should be most afraid is Jesus, right? The one who should be at least in control is Jesus. And yet he's the only one who's actually in control of himself. And here's the key that one key that I think Mark is trying to help his readers to understand is that extravagant devotion brings extraordinary peace. Extravagant devotion. When we devote our lives and our hearts to God extravagantly, not holding anything back, pouring ourselves out to God, the result of that in our lives is an extraordinary peace. No matter what's going on, no matter what we face, no matter how scary the consequences, no matter the thunder and the lightning outside our doors, Mark says that we can have peace in our hearts, an extraordinary peace, an otherworldly peace that will come from our devotion to God. You know, remember, as I talked about at the beginning, Mark's audience is facing the persecution of the Roman army. And you can imagine if in our country, if the U.S. declared Christianity illegal, and that if it was found out that you are a Christian, that you would be killed, how scary that would be for all of us. What about my kids? What about my family? You know, how am I going to support myself? And here, this is what Mark's readers are facing, right? They're saying, you know, my family could just be fed to the lions, and some of them were. And Mark says, you know, yes, this is going on, but you can face it with an extraordinary peace, the same way that Jesus did, when we have hearts that are devoted to God. Everyone around Jesus in this passage is losing their minds, except for the one man who had every reason on earth to be afraid. Jesus' focus was giving his life in an extravagant devotion to God. And so he maintained an extraordinary peace. You know, there's a poem that I like. You may have heard of it. It's kind of a famous poem. It's called If by Rudyard Kipling. And it talks about this kind of heart. And, you know, he's not talking about Jesus in particular, but I do think it's getting at the kind of heart that Jesus' example sets. And I'll just read it to you. It's four stanzas. So anyway, I'll give it to you. He says this. He says, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And which is more, you'll be a man, my son. This is his advice to kind of a putative son that he's talking to. But it's, I think, very similar to the counsel that Mark is giving to the church through the example of Jesus. Right? Jesus is the one who would keep his head when everyone about him is losing theirs and blaming it on him. Jesus is the one who could trust himself, who can trust God when all men around him are doubting. Jesus is the one whose words are twisted and yet continues to be patient, continues to speak the truth. Jesus is the one who has everything that he's given his life to torn up and ripped away from him. And yet he doesn't let it get him down. He doesn't let it discourage him. He continues to trust in the Father. And I guess the question for us tonight is this us? Right? Is this us? The great test of our devotion is how easily we get derailed into emotional swamps by the worries of life. Do I have such devotion in my walk with God that I can withstand the burdens of deceitful colleagues and whiny children and a disagreeable spouse and ungrateful siblings or unreasonable parents and maintain a heart at peace? Or do I let Satan use those things to derail me and to lead me into sin? So I just give you a couple of questions tonight as we think about having a heart of extravagant devotion. And then also letting extravagant devotion bring extraordinary peace in our lives. The first question is this: how would you characterize your spiritual devotion? Is it stingy? Is it efficient? Or is it extravagant? Is it stingy, efficient, or extravagant? Secondly, does your spiritual devotion bring extraordinary peace in your life? Does the devotion that you have to God bring peace through the trials that life brings? If not, then go back to question one and answer that one again. And then last, what is something that you can do this week to devote your heart extravagantly to God? What is something this week that you can do? And we have maybe a few minutes here at the end, but this would be maybe something to share about. And we could talk about all three. But I would love to hear, what is something that inspires you that you feel like, man, I would love to do this week to devote my heart extravagantly to God? So that's what I have for tonight. I hope that's helpful. We can end the recording now, and we'll give people a chance to share for a few minutes.